The Guardian.
Hello, Football Weekly fans. Max here. Little bit of news about today's pod. Barry, unsurprisingly, messed up his recording, and so his audio quality is poor. In perhaps more surprising news, I also messed up my recording. So my audio quality can only be described as poor. Thank you in advance for sticking with it. Lars and Faye both sound great. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, Edison Cavani rescues Manchester United as they come back from two down at Southampton. Arsenal's worst start for 39 years. Was that when it started to go wrong for Wenger? Surely Arteta will get it right. He's worked with Pep. And how big a drum and how high a horse does Barry need before people listen to him about head injuries? Elsewhere, late VAR hits Liverpool. Is that Des Kelly's fault too? Jose's bus works at the bridge. Leeds excite again. And there's good and bad news for Newcastle. Good news, they won, and bad news, they won. We'll have an enlarged Fitbar corner as Neil Lennon's job hangs in the balance. Brackets quite possibly gone by the time you hear this. There's eighth-tier joy in the FA Cup. Power cuts in Malta. Your questions too. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen. Hello.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Faye Carruthers.
Morning.
Hello, Barry Glendening.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Right then, let's start St Mary, shall we? Southampton 2, Manchester United 3. United, the first side in Premier League history to win four consecutive away games despite trailing in each one. Eight straight away top flight wins for the first time ever. Almost sounds like I should announce they're top of the league after those sorts of stats. They're not. But Edison Cavani's two goals and an assist changed the game after Southampton were two up at half time. Lars, they felt like peak centre forward goals, these.
They were. They really add something. And I'm delighted to see Cavani at it. You know, he's a tremendous player to watch, and you always worry a little bit when a player who's been brilliant for a lot of years like he has, and he comes to the Premier League at he's not 25 anymore, and that he might not give a fair representation of himself. But you know, you see what he's all about here. He's a guy who's he does look after himself very well. He's in good nick for his age, so you see him running around, and his movement is very clever. He has garnered this sort of reputation as a player who will miss chances, and he will miss one now and again, but part of that is because his movement is so good that he gets into a lot of good positions for these chances. And I thought you saw both goals really were a great example of just how clever he is in the box.
Yeah, you mentioned his movement. It's interesting for the equaliser, isn't it, that he runs past Van der Beek. So Van der Beek could make the same movement but just doesn't. Is that, Barry, do you think that is instinct or is that learned? Don't speak from experience here, but what do you think?
I'd sit on the fence and say it's a little bit of both. I mean, there was quite a lot of goals in that game I thought were pretty undefendable. I think the defenders could have done better for those, but Cavani's a wily old fox. He's been around the block. He's a poacher. His movement in the area is excellent. I think a match of the day too last night. Alan Shearer was talking about things Tammy Abraham could do to improve his game. And, you know, you can learn these things, but I suspect with Cavani it's more instinct, you know, just quickness of thought and that's why he made the run and maybe Donny van der Beek didn't.
I was on my 1 millionth lockdown walk with Mrs. Rushton during the first half of this game, Faye, and I slyly checked my phone for the scores because you're not really meant to check your phone on a lockdown walk. And I saw Southampton were 2-0 up and I was like, well, I presumed that they were absolutely battered United. But the first half wasn't really like that, was it?
No, it wasn't. Although Walker-Peters hit the post as well. So, you know, they had plenty of chances. But Manchester United just looked a little bit more polished than they have done previously, I thought. And then particularly in the second half, Edinson Cavani making all the difference. But Bruno Fernandes is fantastic. I know we've heaped praise on him throughout the season since he joined. But, you know, he really does make an enormous difference. And I quite liked this Manchester United side. And I liked the fact, you know, that they showed that kind of gall to come back in the second half as well, because that's not what you've seen from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's United recently. And I thought it was a decent performance.
Lars, does this mean Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's a genius again?
I think if you track United's results under Solskjaer, And the perspective from which it makes the most sense is if you accept that United's chances are generally better against teams who like to push up and who like to press high and play high up the field, whereas they struggle more against the teams that sit back. I mean, that usually holds true. Southampton being one of the most sort of aggressive pressing teams in the league, you'd expect United to do okay. What I thought was interesting is, you know, if you look at the goals, they weren't like counterattacks. And I did think in the second half, there were more instances than usual of United actually, you know, putting together decent passing movements and trying to break down an opponent. And I really do think, you know, having Van de Beek and Fernandes on the field at the same time helps. You know, Van de Beek was one of the sort of the quiet heroes of the day for me, you know, picking a lot of intelligent passes and just sort of keeping things ticking over in midfield there. And I thought it was a very decent United performance and completely agree with Faye. The half-time thing, I mean, United were the best team in the first half, and they have some really bad misses, that they should have put away, and you concede two goals, you know, one from a corner and the other one from a direct free kick. That sort of thing can happen. And I was kind of like dreading coming on here today, trying to have to be the guy who said that actually Solskjaer did okay and it wasn't really his fault. So I'm kind of relieved that they came back and won it, so that the score in the end reflected the fact that United were the better team here. So someone noted on social media, and I'm sorry, I forgot who it was, that Solskjaer seems to have a real knack of defeating managers who are like sort of hipster favourites. It's like Thomas Tuchel and Nagelsmann and now Hasenhüttl. So if he had this sort of wall, I don't think Solskjaer would do this, he's not a very petty man, but if he had a wall of like portrait photos of all the managers he's defeated, you'd see a lot of the sort of the people who the clever tactics bloggers really like up on that wall. I mean, I do think that's a natural consequence of the fact that United are definitely like better in games where they can counterattack and against teams who press high. Though there is a really interesting stat here, and shout out to Christian Selsen on Twitter for finding this. Jan Bednarek has scored 3 goals for Southampton. He scored against United, he scored against Wolves, and he scored against Chelsea. Now, in all of those games, Southampton were 2-0 up and lost 3-2. So just not, so it's really important for Bednarek not to score, I think. It just goes wrong every single time.
And also, if you're playing Manchester United, what you need to do is bring in an anti-hipster, get in Big Sam or Pulis or Warnock to manage the team just for that day, and Solskjaer will have absolutely no chance. On James Ward-Prowse, only David Beckham among English players has scored more direct free kicks in the Premier League. Faye, how close is he to getting close to an England? I mean, you can't just have like a special teams free kick taker. He's quite good at the other bits of football too, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. But I mean, for set pieces, he's absolutely superb. And that free kick on Sunday, the fact it squeezed in, there was literally like inches for it to squeeze past De Gea. It was absolutely beautiful. And, you know, Gareth Southgate, the England manager, absolutely loves that side of his game, and he can do various other things as well. He's quite a flexible player. There's just something about the maturity when he plays, and then the second he puts a dead ball situation, he's fantastic, and I think he deserves a place in the Euro squad for sure.
Now, Edinson Cavani could face a 3-game ban if the FA deemed that he used discriminatory or racist language in an Instagram story shared from his account on Sunday evening. The FA has confirmed it's investigating the post. The word in question was the same one used by Cavani's Uruguay teammate Luis Suarez to Patrice Evra during that game between Liverpool and Man United in 2011. At the time, Suarez argued that the word was a term of endearment, not intended as a form of racial abuse. However, the FA's disciplinary panel rejected the explanation. Suarez was banned for 8 games. Apparently, Cavani deleted the post when he was told how it could be interpreted in the UK. To the Emirates, Arsenal 1, Wolves 2. The latest news is that Raul Jimenez is conscious in hospital and is speaking. It was after a really nasty clash of heads with David Luiz. Luiz played on before going off at half-time. Faye, you were there. It sounded terrible on TV.
It was terrible in the ground, to be honest. The sound, obviously with no fans in there, you heard it, and instantly thought both players had been knocked out. But David Luiz, you know, was on his knees within 3 or 4 minutes and getting treatment. But it was really worrying. I mean, I think it shocked everybody in the stadium, to be honest, to see Raul Jimenez and to see the reaction of the players as well. All the players had their hands over their mouths, and it was just, you know, really worrying. So it's fantastic news to hear that he's responding well to treatment and is conscious. And we'll wait to see you know, exactly what impact that's had. I thought it was going to affect the game because the game had started at such a frenetic pace to begin with. That happened, the incident, within the first 5 minutes. And it took the players about another 10 minutes or so to settle back into the game. I really thought it was going to affect them psychologically. But then the game just sparked into life, and it was such a thrilling game to watch. And I mean, why I work in football, I don't know, with these kind of predictions. I thought it was going to be goalless because Wolves don't score in the first half of games very often. And Arsenal just can't score in the Premier League at the moment. So I thought it was going to be a really drab 0-0, and it was a brilliant game. But Arsenal, I've covered Arsenal a lot this season. I speak to Mikel Arteta quite often, and he keeps talking about this being a work in progress, but I mean, it has to be better than that. Their captain, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, since signing that contract, his body language for me is all wrong. And I know it sounds very cliched because it gets talked about a lot, but genuinely, every single time I watch him, he's almost like, I heard Troy Deeney talking actually about the fact that he almost comes away from goal a lot. So he's not in the six-yard box, he's not driving forward, and that might be a confidence thing for sure. But he had an opportunity when Rob Holding headed the ball over the top. Aubameyang should have jumped that tiny bit higher, and a striker on form just gives that extra little 10% that would make him get his head to the ball, and he doesn't. He just, you know, doesn't get up there, and Holding gets it and puts it over. And then he had a one-on-one chance with Rui Patricio, having nicked the ball off Patricio, which again, he was a second off the pace with that. But then he had his back to goal and he just didn't take advantage. And by that time, Wolves had reorganised themselves and got back to clear it. So there's something not quite right there. That's from an Arsenal perspective. Wolves were superb, I thought.
We'll go back to the concussion thing in a second, but just on, for the game itself, I mean, I thought when Jimenez went off, thought, I'm not sure they've got a natural replacement. And we've talked about Fabio Silva, you know, a lot of money being spent on him, and he'd only scored one goal in his career. We thought it must have been a very good goal to have cost 35 million. But I thought he was brilliant last night, love.
Yeah, when he comes on, like, he looks like a sort of Renaissance prince who's just hit puberty, you know. He's got with this sort of slightly sort of flowing hair, and, you know, he doesn't look very grizzled. And yeah, so you think, oh, well. But no, he put himself about really well. And, you know, it's tough to replace Jimenez in terms of everything he does leading the line for that team. And I thought he did really well. And, you know, it was one of those when he was taken off later to put Max Kilman on for an extra defender. He always feels a little bit harsh when a substitute is substituted back off. But, I mean, it was very clear that that was a tactical thing and not a reflection on his efforts at all. I mean, for a young man, I thought he did very well.
I thought Daniel Podence's touch, for his first touch for that goal, was the touch of the weekend for me, Baz.
It was a wonderful touch, the way he flicked it over Gabriel before putting it past Leno. Absolutely delightful. And Adama Traore deserves credit as well. He was instrumental in both goals. Skinned Kieran Tierney for one, and then beat Granit Xhaka in midfield for the other. And it wasn't out on the wing. It was in the centre of the pitch, which is not where we expect to see him perform his little bits of magic.
The high point of Adama Traore was when he went down and Rob Holding yelled and was picked up by cameras, he's built like a brick shithouse. How's he gone down like that? Ian Stone, the comedian, wrote, that was about as shit as I've seen Arsenal play in quite some time. And there's a fair bit of competition. Jack got in touch to say, has Arteta been overrated by the media? Seems to always say he's better than Lampard, Solskjaer, because you can see what he's trying to achieve. What a load of bollocks, says Jack. Lars, an Arteta review.
Well, yeah, when Faye was saying it's a work in progress, that's probably true, but currently a lot of work and not a lot of progress on show, which is sort of not very positive. I find it very hard to pin down what they're good at, because I was sort of also swept away with this a little bit. You know, Arteta, he looks the part, he comes across really well. You know, whenever you read the sort of behind the scenes at Arsenal articles, everyone says very nice things about him. But then again, for these behind the scenes articles, people do tend to say nice things, because if the reporter is not going to write nice things, then he tends to not get access to things behind the scenes. And there has been a sort of vague sense of increased competence. You know, you've had these games against the bigger teams where they've done well, But what we haven't really seen is sort of like, how does Arteta want them to play? I'm slightly baffled by it. Like, they don't really do any pressing. Like, they're one of the teams in the league who press up the field the least. And perhaps it's lazy of us to assume that Arteta would want them to play with a high press just because he's, you know, been an assistant under Pep Guardiola and stuff. But I'm very surprised that Arteta set up a team to be as passive as they are. They're very, very slow in terms of in possession when they're trying to go forward. The passing game is so slow. And you see very often when their players get the ball in the opponent's half, they just kind of have to stop and look around and see sort of where are my teammates and what am I supposed to do now? And that seems to be a very bad sign to me in terms of the just what they're doing in the training ground and building attacking patterns and all this sort of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They don't ever seem instinctive. There's no like beautiful one-touch football knowing exactly where your teammates are. They don't just seem to be playing like a team at all at the moment, Arsenal. And that must be incredibly frustrating for Mikel Arteta. He's talked about it, you know, perhaps taking three or four windows for him to get what he wants. And I think he needs to be given time because this has always been the problem at Arsenal. I think it's almost a year to the day since Unai Emery was sacked, that they have to just change the model and give Arteta time. And I know that means that some fans are going to be disappointed with performances, certainly results as well at the moment. But, you know, that's the only way they're going to improve in the future.
I get that. But if you're saying, we'll be good in three or four windows, like they've just handed a huge contract to Willian, who's 32. They've just handed a huge contract to Aubameyang, who's 31. And you can't then say, oh, well, we'll be really good in 2 years. Well, you won't be because those dudes will be really old then. I mean, and it's like you need to. This is not a team you're not really building for the future at the moment. You've spent a lot of money on guys who have to be good right now. One of whom isn't even registered to play in the Premier League, actually,
which is
obviously not Arteta's fault. Before anyone like ats me, but you know, I looking at this squad, a lot of the money they're spending is sort of tied up in guys who are, you know, in the wrong end of their career. So, like, all this talk about how they'll be good in a few years just seems a bit weird then.
Equally, though, you've got Bukayo Saka, Reece Nelson and Joe Willock playing really well, you know, so that they've got youngsters.
And Thomas Partey to come back as well, who did make a difference when we saw him briefly. How many windows do you think a manager can say they need to give them grace? I just think give me 15 to 20 windows and I think this team will be great. Now, Barry, Dennis says, are the concussion protocol questions the same as for the fit and proper person test? Are there any wrong answers? Adam says, as I said in the intro, can you get Baz a bigger horse with a louder drum as he seeks answers for how David Luiz continued to play after that awful clash of heads with Jimenez? Concussion substitutes are being trialled in the FA Cup third round. An IFAB committee gave assent to the use of additional permanent substitutes in the event of a player being concussed during a match. But why do they need to be trialled? I mean, it's just so obvious. Take Luiz off, bring on another defender, assess him properly. Well, I don't need to get on the horse with the drum with you. You can do it.
Well, you're dead right. There's no need for trials. They should be introduced. Football's been left behind by other sports. There is no need for trials. I mean, I think there's a suggestion that some managers will abuse it, the fact, you know, and players will feign head injuries so that they can be taken off. But if that happens, investigate it accordingly and hopefully it won't be abused. But that seems to be the only reason why it's not being introduced.
And actually, it would be so rare. And when it did happen, it would involve a footballer having to act, him having to try and work out the wrong thing to say in the concussion test. It just needs an independent doctor. The Premier League has loads of money. It just seems so obvious. I know you were tweeting yesterday about, you know, stories of players with concussion not knowing what day it was or having a clue where they were. And Joachim sent a great story from England-Norway in 1992 where Tore Pedersen went down after a nasty challenge. The Norwegian physio checked if he was okay by asking him what the score was. Pedersen said it was 0-0. Which it was. I mean, obviously, for an England-Norway game, it would have to be 0-0. But the physio, for some reason, thought that England were 1-0 up. So he took him off and bought on Henning Berg.
And this might not be true, but the urban legend there is that Kenny Dalglish was watching the game and he was sort of, oh, Henning Berg's really good, let's sign him. So that's part of why Henning Berg ended up at Blackburn, is that he came on for that game. So you need to thank the sort of slightly confused Norwegian physio, Trygve Kase, who was like our Gary Lewin, is the guy who's been there forever for England. Yeah, we had a similar character who was like looking after the national team forever and ever, and he was slightly confused on that occasion. And yeah, it worked out well for Henning Berg.
There's a friend of mine at home in Ireland who was taken off in a hurling match after getting a bang on the head because he scored a couple of points over his own crossbar. They realised, maybe he's not fully compos mentis here.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at the Amex. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Brighton 1, Liverpool 1. Is it a penalty? Hussein says, can the wise old bearded one, Lars Lars, provide us with a definition of what is meant by clear and obvious, specifically in reference to Traore and Welbeck? This is the Welbeck incident. Both probably penalties, only one given. Wise old bearded one, Lars, was it a penalty in injury time, Robertson on Welbeck?
Well, yeah, that was a foul. The only question is whether the whole sort of... The high bar for involvement from VAR was met and blah, blah, blah. But I honestly, like, this is going to turn into yet another VAR discussion, delightfully. But I actually think that issue there is sort of slightly bigger than VAR, because I think if that it's one of the classic cases of if that happens anywhere else on the pitch, it's given as a foul and nobody complains, right? Robertson's going to clear the ball. Welbeck sort of nicks in and touches the ball first so that Robertson misses the ball and whacks Welbeck instead. Like, we've seen that happen a bunch of times in football. It's not that uncommon an incident, and it's given as a foul because you're not allowed to just kick people, even if you mean it or not. But the problem for me is more to the fact that we have an area of the field in the 18-yard box where every kind of foul, no matter how unintentional or niggly or random, ends up being given as an 80% chance of a goal to the attacking team. And that leads to a lot of strange behaviours. It leads to attackers, you know, falling to the ground at the first sight of contact because they know if they get a foul, it's so, so valuable. It leads to, like, sort of rampant holding in the box for set pieces because everyone just kind of agrees that it's no fun if you give a penalty every time someone tugs a shirt a little bit. So that's gone a bit weird. So it's a sort of quirk of the laws that I'm not sure is fully fit for purpose. And you can take VAR out of the question, but the thing is, most of the time the ref is going to give that as a penalty. That if you take away VAR, there is a slight chance he doesn't see it, but I don't think you can have a laws of the game that only makes sense if the referee doesn't see everything that happens. That doesn't seem to make sense to me. I mean, it is a foul. The question is, it feels completely disproportionate that what Robertson does should be penalised by an almost 80% chance of a goal to Brighton. I mean, that doesn't feel right, but that still has to be a foul. So, I mean, I think that's a wider issue here than just VAR.
I mean, in this game, look, they had the late penalty, which was, you know, would have been annoying. They had two goals disallowed for offside, one which was one of those incredibly close ones. Interestingly, in Holland, they have thicker lines. Yes, Barry, your hand is up.
Well, sorry, I was just going to say, Jurgen Klopp complains about fixture scheduling every season. Apart from the first season he was in England, he has complained about fixture scheduling, complained about his team having to play too many games every single season. That's five seasons in a row he's complained. Now, this season he's blaming COVID, but I very much suspect that if COVID hadn't happened, he would still be complaining. So
I thought Brighton deserved something from this game.
I completely agree. And I was always like, I tweeted earlier in the autumn that Brighton are just seem to be fully committed to playing quite well without getting results. And I was all ready to retweet myself. But they got the point in the end. I mean, they are very impressive in a way, Brighton. They knock the ball around well, they press high, they make it difficult for you, but they do seem to have a bit of a glass jaw, and they do seem to find new and more interesting ways to not get the results you feel like they deserve. So I'm kind of glad they got a point in the end, even if it came about in a slightly frustrating way.
Game of the weekend then was at Stamford Bridge, two of the top sides in the division, Chelsea 0, Tottenham 0. Was this tactically fascinating, Faye, or incredibly boring?
Boring, I'm afraid. Sorry. I know for all those tacticians out there, you'll have loved it. But unfortunately, I think we could all predict that Jose Mourinho was going to have his Spurs team set up to defend really deeply. Chelsea just couldn't break it down. Tammy Abraham was really disappointing. Timo Werner obviously had a goal disallowed. It just wasn't for me. I thought there were so many more interesting games than this across the weekend. And it was, you know, one of those typical Premier League games that promises much and delivers not a lot.
I think it's interesting you mentioned Tammy Abraham, because on commentary they sort of talked about Abraham, you know, Giroud would have scored all these chances. And I'm thinking Reece James is whipping across in at 100 miles an hour behind Abraham's head. And, you know, Giroud is just scoring all these goals. He's not even on the pitch. I don't know. I felt a bit sorry for Abraham in that situation, Lars.
Maybe, but I just think when you have a sort of fresh-faced Premier League debutant in Joe Roden there, I think Giroud would have very much enjoyed, trying to face off with him. But I don't know what you're talking about, Faye. Well, you said they're both. Tottenham, they came to win. They were very upset they didn't get 3 points, and that's how they play it. Because that's what Jose Mourinho said at halftime, at full time. Sorry. So that's clearly how it was. I thought that was magnificent. I'm really enjoying Jose Mourinho being back to his sort of trolling best. You know things are going quite well for him when he's just absolutely like having a good time in the media the way he is now. I have to enjoy any manager who can like put on Ben Davies as a winger right towards the end, leaving sort of Bale and Lucas on the bench and saying, oh no, well, we won it 3 points. We definitely didn't play for the draw. It's really good. The key to this with Mourinho, you have to not take anything he says seriously ever. And once you accept that, then he becomes a tremendously funny character.
There was one thing he did say, which you have to take seriously, because he was referring specifically to this game, but I think he was referring to also his entire life in general, and it was, I'm not happy, and this is the best feeling of all.
He did say, we're not even in the race. We're not a horse. We are just a pony. You see the difference? Joe Roden was at Swansea. Thiago Silva is one of the best centre-backs in the world. Maybe a month of Thiago's salary plays Joe 1 year of salary. I actually thought Joe Roden had a really good game, Barry, apart from just trying to lose it at the end when he didn't put enough on that header for Giroud. But I thought he acquitted himself pretty well and looked like quite a nice footballer.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. He is a good footballer. And before the game, Jose was interviewed and he said, well, we bought him, we trust him, we rate him. And that's fair enough. He is a good player. I would have felt really bad for him if Giroud had scored that goal off his mistake at the end, but no, I wasn't surprised he played well. He's a good footballer.
That's a very Jose thing, though, because again, he was asked about Joe Roden's performance, and rather than saying, you know, yeah, that was great, he actually just picked out like two or three mistakes from him, and that's all he gave him. It's like, come on.
Hugo Lloris made one brilliant save from Mason Mount. Pretty much the only thing that happened. Barry, you said you wanted Tottenham to win, and it made you feel dirty. Do you still want Tottenham to win games now you've seen how... like after the City game, I think we all said it, you know, if you play like this, you have to win because it's really... It just feels so dirty, you know?
I am warming to Jose again, and I don't like it. And Jonathan Wilson wrote a column in The Observer yesterday saying much the same thing. And he is starting to get good press again. It's almost like him and Jurgen Klopp are just switching places, because Jurgen's very spiky and cranky at the moment. But yeah, we'll see how it goes. But it was a dirty performance.
Yeah, Everton 0, Leeds 1. Faye, you talked about, you know, how when an Arsenal player gets the ball, it looks like they don't have anyone to pass to and they don't know where anyone else is going to be. I think Leeds are just sort of the diametric opposite of this, aren't they? They are such a joy. And I'm sure part of me is just being brainwashed by everyone who's told me about Bielsa's side, but I love watching them play. I just genuinely think when they attack, it looks poetic.
It's beautiful, and you're not brainwashed at all, because what you're seeing in front of you is what we're all seeing. It's just, they're such fun to watch. I think that's the word. People forget that football's supposed to be fun. And, you know, from one extreme to another, Chelsea Spurs to Everton Leeds, which probably should have been 5-all in the end. It was just brilliant. And as you say, Leeds are amazing to watch. They had 23 attempts. Unlucky, in fact, not to have had more goals. I mean, you have to remember Everton were without Seamus Coleman and Luca Dean, which, you know, really made a big difference. But they're struggling a little bit. They haven't kept a clean sheet since their opening day win over Tottenham. But, you know, they were up against a Leeds side that, as we know, press really high and are exciting to watch. And then for Rafinha to get the goal, he'd been the standout player on the park. So for him to get the goal 10 minutes from time was perfect.
They are terrific to watch. And I think this is the point that, you know, there was some whining last week when Bielsa was sort of nominated to the sort of global manager of the year. Some suggested that he hasn't necessarily done better than other managers. And I think the point a lot of people miss is that this is a team still consisting of a lot of guys who were sort of considered mid-table championship players who have just really, and not all credit should go to Bielsa. I think the players themselves have taken on this challenge in just an extraordinary way and are making huge sacrifices to keep to Bielsa's sort of fitness demands and keep this, they keep the weight down and all this sort of stuff they have to do. But the players have done incredibly well, but Bielsa has galvanized that club in a way that's truly extraordinary, and they play in a way that just kind of touches and moves people and has this sort of profound impact. And I think that's a huge part of what it's about. Like, it's not just about results, it's about the way they make you feel watching them.
Yeah, Calvin Phillips, we should say, had a lovely game in centre midfield. And we should also mention Jordan Pickford played well, because when he doesn't play well, we always mention it. So to be fair to Jordan, well done, you had a good game. To the annual Man City 5 Burnley 0, Gary. Can you add anything from the previous Man City 5's Burnley 0 or not?
Not a huge amount. It was a handy fill-up for Man City, who've been finding goals hard to come by lately. Burnley, I think, are in serious trouble. Their defending is absolutely atrocious. A couple of positives for them would be Josh Benson made his debut. 20-year-old they picked up from Arsenal when he was released, and he came close to scoring for them for a free kick and was reasonably good on the ball on the rare occasions Burnley got the ball. But they are in big trouble, because, I don't know, there's no shame in losing to Man City, but that defending is awful, and Sean Dyche has a big job on his hands to sort it out.
Yeah, well done to Riyad Mahrez. It was a nice hat trick, wasn't it? So Selhurst Park, Palace 0, Newcastle 2. I mean, I saw, Barry, you had fun on social media with Newcastle fans on Friday night after they won, and it's very hard to tell if they were happy they won or not happy that they won.
Well, I think what happens is they're briefly happy they won, and then they quickly plunge back into the misery that comes with following Newcastle, a team whose owner is unambitious. And, you know, we had Steve Harmison on, the cricketer, on the radio yesterday, and he was never more passionate. He was on ostensibly to talk about the England 2020 team, but he was never more passionate than when ranting and railing when we got him on the subject of Newcastle. And I get the frustration, the Newcastle fans, but they think the rest of us don't know why they're unhappy. We do know why they're unhappy, but fans of lots of clubs are unhappy. And I would imagine Danny Murphy, who said on the match of the day, "I don't know what they want from Steve Bruce," that will have incurred their wrath. But it was a good win for them. They left it late. I thought Crystal Palace were the better side by a distance in that game. But once again, Newcastle perform a smash and grab.
It's interesting. I mentioned on the radio that I'd watched Newcastle and they were sticking the place out, and they put it on social media. And so then some Newcastle account retweeted it. And then the Newcastle Chronicle did an article about how me and Alan Shearer are the only people who understand what Newcastle fans feel. And I think I'd only said, God, I thought they were rubbish against Tottenham or something like that. Joe on this subject says, which team's fans will be most disappointed that fans are allowed back in? Any advances on Newcastle, Lars?
Nope.
Fair enough.
No, but listen, I'm on a serious note. I am very sympathetic to their plight in the sense that I think this is a very sort of modern football thing. There are more sort of solid glass ceilings than before. And if you support a team that's of their size, like, you kind of know you're going to finish mid-table in the Premier League at best, and you're not going to reach any higher than that unless you get some sort of a dubious source of tremendous income come your way. So I guess it becomes on the clubs to try to create enthusiasm by playing in a certain way or by having a manager they can really like identify with for some reason. Or did they have to try to put some makeup on this situation somehow, because they are in a sort of mid-table pit of doom where the sort of best case, the most exciting thing that can happen is that they can get a relegation fight, I guess. And I don't know what the answer to that is. And I think they're not the only club in that situation. I feel like the cups should be an escape from this. I mean, the clubs who are in this sort of mid-table doldrum of doom, they should really focus on the domestic cups, but they never seem to do that. It's very odd.
Steve Bruce, I mean, if fans want an affinity with him, he is quite Geordie. I mean, yes. Who do they want? Jeff from Biker Grove? And, you know, who could they possibly get to be more Geordie?
Anyway. Hotel Port from Alan Partridge.
Finally, West Brom 1, Sheffield United 0. Stewie says, my team, the Baggies, won. Did Barry see it? Did it really happen? Mark says, is 20 points the new 40 points? Well, that was a vital win for them. And Sheffield United, Faye, are in all sorts of bother, aren't they?
Yeah, it's not looking good for Chris Wilder's side. I mean, we've spoken on this pod before about the injuries that they've had. But at the same time, something's just not quite clicking for them. And before this game, they'd put in decent performances, but just weren't getting the results. And I still feel that they're going to come good because, you know, they were so solid last season. But you start to get a little bit worried for them when you look at the table, 1 point from 10 games, and they've got some really awful fixtures coming up for them. Manchester United, Southampton, Leicester, Everton. You know, they're going to have to start putting in the performances soon. And goals are such a big problem for Chris Wilder's side at the minute.
I've seen two of their games this season. I thought they were pretty good in both of them. It is just scoring that's a problem. They created so many chances against West Brom, couldn't put them away. And Rian Brewster, the record signing, it's just not working out. He's not even starting anymore.
I thought this game was actually quite good, which was almost disappointing. Cause I was on the Saturday night, I'd had a glass of wine, I was sort of ready to be all sarcastic on Twitter about how bad this game was, and then it was actually really fun. There were a ton of chances. And I didn't really feel for Sheffield United. They had something like 22 shots or something here, 21, I think. And yeah, how they didn't get a goal here, I have no idea. And you can look at that two ways. Either if you keep playing like they did here, they'll start picking up points. But on the other hand, if they can play like this against West Brom and not get any points, then that's not very good.
Yeah. Well done to Conor Gallagher as well. I think he's a nice player, and it was a nice finish. Although a touch of the ankle, but if you could score with your ankle from 25 yards, then you're probably quite good at football.
It's quite important for West Brom as well. You know, Slaven Bilic talked about the psychological boost that it gave them. And he said that, you know, his players had started having a look in the papers with people suggesting when they're going to get their first win. And you know, that's not a good sign when players starting to read the papers. I would say stay away as far as possible from the papers when you're in that kind of situation.
And absolutely, if you're a footballer, definitely don't listen to podcasts. That would be a disastrous idea. All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, Ewan Murray will join us for an extended Fitbar Corner. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Ewan Murray joins us for Fitbar Corner. Ewan, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. I wonder what I'm here to speak about.
So, Alloa's win over Hearts. So let's start then with Celtic and Neil Lennon. There is a habit of managers to be fired after we've finished recording, but before the podcast is published to the wonderful listeners. Is that going to be the case in this instance?
I think there's a chance. I think the situation around Neil Lennon and Celtic is now so toxic it can't run on. There are two issues in play. One is Celtic don't have an obvious and viable alternative, although I would say as of yesterday they're probably at the point where something, anything is going to be, you know, required to get them out of this situation. And the other thing is actually, you know, the scenes we saw from Celtic Park last night with the fans, I mean, it was disgraceful really, turning up, police called, missiles been thrown at players and staff. If I was on the Celtic board, I'm not sure I would be minded to bow to that kind of behaviour, or or be seen to bow to that kind of behaviour. So that might temper what they're doing for now, but Celtic for now, I mean, it looks, in a football sense, as if they're in a rut that they can't get out of without some kind of change.
Why are they in this rut?
Well, there's two key things. I mean, it's very like all these things, there's a lot of issues at play. You can't absolve the manager from blame. Celtic, to me, at the start of the season, had the strongest team in the country, and they haven't performed like that. I don't think anyone could have foreseen how quick this kind of decline is, quickly this decline has happened. It's been really, really sharp. Two key issues. The recruitment, especially over the summer, has been really poor. So from a position of strength, not for the first time, actually, Celtic didn't sign well, and that is causing them a problem. Certain areas of the team are really, really weak and haven't been properly supplemented. And also, there's a group of players there who have their eyes on other things. They think they should be playing in the Premier League in England. Actually, they think they should be playing in the top 10 of the Premier League in England. They've had their heads turned, and their attitude on the pitch now is a problem, and their attitude around the club is a problem. And that has kind of seeped into the way Celtic are playing. I mean, you know, these Celtic fans and the club care passionately about winning 10 Scottish titles in a row. Bluntly, a lot of these players couldn't care less. It doesn't matter to their career. They're looking at their next challenge. And this has all kind of collided at once, whereby we've seen the kind of insipid performances that have appeared over the last, actually all season really. Even when they were winning games earlier in the season, they weren't really convincing. Ultimately, the managers pay for these things, right? And the managers have to manage players, have to manage situations, but it also doesn't reflect at all well on these players. You know, I will be seen as defending Neil Lennon, and that's not my point. As I say, can't be absolved of blame, and he is responsible. But if you look back to the Ferencvaros game, the Champions League qualifiers, where Celtic were embarrassingly beaten after the game, Neil Lennon had a real broadside at players, said if these guys don't want to be here, they should leave. Now, the genie was kind of out the bottle at that point, and he's spent the next few months trying to put it back in, and he's been complimentary and supportive publicly of the players. But I think reading, you know, not too difficultly between the lines, what he said there was what he felt, that these players were a problem, and that has just lingered on, really. I mean, I've been amazed at the level of vitriol toward Neil Lennon. I mean, as a Celtic player, he won, you know, went to UEFA Cup final, I cut off the top of my head, 5 titles, 3 Scottish Cups, League Cups, UEFA Cup final, did well in the Champions League last 16. As a manager, first time around, the famous Barcelona result. I think as a manager, he's won, again, I think 5 titles, say 3 Scottish Cups, they're in the Scottish Cup final later this month. Neil Lennon's a successful Celtic guy, and a Celtic guy through and through. And as recently as last season, where Celtic turned around what looked like a difficult situation in January, you know, I think he was widely regarded as a very good manager. And in the space of a few months, obviously things haven't gone right. And I keep stressing, you can't defend the manager really when this is going on. But the personal abuse and the scale of the abuse has taken me and quite a lot of people aback, actually.
So Ewan, I suspect a lot of people listening don't watch Celtic very often. They just see now recently that the results are not what you'd expect, and they might see some fury on social media. Could you sort of say very briefly what's actually going wrong on the pitch? Why are they losing these games? What are they not doing? What should they be doing differently?
Lars, their defending has been hopeless. They're losing goal after goal after goal, basic goal after basic goal after basic goal. They signed Shane Duffy to shore up their defence. It looked, you know, to all intents and purposes, the ideal Celtic signing, a lifelong fan, an Irishman, you know, a warrior, this is what they want. It's been a disaster. You can't even get in the team. And they lack width and pace. They don't have a winger who's quick to break down teams such as Ross County, who they played yesterday. James Forrest, one of their key guys, has been injured, but they should have more than that. They badly need wide pace. But it's the loss of goals. I mean, last week, Sparta Prague have beaten them 4-1 now twice. Last week in the second of those games, Celtic actually played pretty well, I thought, for long stages of the game in Prague. You're almost not allowed to say that, but the concession of horrendous goals undermines everything they've been doing. And that's, you know, it's going to bite them, especially in Europe. They're playing against better teams, but it's now happening against pretty basic average teams in Scotland, and the whole thing's come to a head.
Big Sam, what do you reckon?
I mean, that's the point. It's very hard to, if you asked me to give you 5 people who can manage Celtic, I couldn't really do it. And also Celtic, I don't want to say arrogance. Celtic fans have a perception of the kind of manager and kind of style of football their club should have. Now, I dare say when you're winning, maybe that goes by the wayside a little bit, but they would turn their nose up, I think, at certain people, put it that way, even in the current circumstance. I mean, you can't, you know, my thing is always, when you can't name viable alternatives to the guy in charge, well, it's very difficult to make a change.
We should mention, you know, Alaba's win over Hearts. That's a great result for them as well, isn't it?
The line broke up when you were saying that, sorry. Say that again? It was a great win for Alaba. Hearts were hopeless, absolutely hopeless. And it was an embarrassing result for Hearts. I'm quite happy to admit and concede that. Nowhere to hide on that front. In a wider news sense, it was kind of overtaken 24 hours later.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, thanks for coming on, Ewan. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Ewan Murray there. In the FA Cup, well done to Greg Bukowski's Marine from the 8th tier. The 8th tier, not something you want to be in Boris's system. You'd really have a problem, wouldn't it? Anyway, they beat Havant and Waterlooville. Niall Cumming scoring in the very last minute of extra time with a hilariously scrappy goal. Well done to Chorley as well. He won 2-1 at Peterborough. I imagine the third round draw will be brought into disrepute by the One Show later. Sunderland have sacked Phil Parkinson, Barry. Ross Gregory says Sunderland are now without 1, a chairman, 2, a first-team manager, 3, a head of recruitment, 4, an academy manager, 5, an under-18s manager. Added absentee owners and part owners, plus a financial hole in the accounts. You can see the issues at the club go deeper than on the League One pitch. No first-team assistant manager, no under-18s assistant manager, 2.
Yeah, it's quite the mess. And I wouldn't expect much better from a club that, you know, for all the complaining of Newcastle fans, their club is far from the biggest basket case in that neck of the woods. And Parkinson's results weren't good enough. And to be honest, I was unaware that there seems to be absolutely nobody there in any kind of position of authority. So I'm not sure who's going to take training today. Will there be training? A big mess, and it has been for a very long time.
The Wilson Glendening dream ticket. It could happen. Thanks to everybody who said nice things about the Maradona pod we did last week. Over the weekend, I don't know if you saw Marcella tweeting to dear friends outside Argentina, the doctor in charge of his surgery and post-op care is currently having a tear-ridden meltdown live on TV as police raid his house and legal proceedings rumoured to start against him. Possibly ill-judged, but gripping, she said. Yeah, Argentine prosecutors are investigating Maradona's doctor for possible manslaughter. Police in Buenos Aires have searched the house and private clinic of Leopoldo Luque as they tried to establish if there was negligence in Maradona's treatment following surgery. His daughters have pressed for details about their father's medication. He had a successful operation on a brain blood clot earlier in November, was due to be treated for alcohol dependency. Dr. Luque has stressed he's cooperating with the authorities and that he'd done his best for Maradona until the very end. Some very sad news about Papabuba Diop, former Senegal, Fulham and Portsmouth midfielders, died at the age of 42, made 129 appearances in the Premier League, had spells as well at West Ham and Birmingham City, played for Senegal in 2002, scoring the winner in the tournament's opening game when Senegal beat France 1-0. He died of motor neuron disease. Philippe knew him and said he was a wonderful man. Kingston Tangier said, "My first wow moment in football was Papabuba Diop in 2002 against France. I'd watched football before and enjoyed it, but that was the moment for me." So obviously we send our thoughts and best wishes to his family. While we've been recording, Wolves have released the following update on Raul Jimenez, who suffered a fractured skull during the early stages of last night's win at Arsenal. Raul is comfortable following an operation last night, which he underwent in a London hospital. He's since seen his partner Daniela and is now resting. He'll remain under observation for a few days while he begins his recovery. The club would like to thank the medical staff at Arsenal, the NHS paramedics, hospital staff and surgeons, who through their skill and early response were of such help. The club asks that Raul and his family are now afforded a period of space and privacy before any further updates are provided in due course. We, of course, wish him well. Lars, since you are here, we'll do a little 30 seconds on the Norwegian champions Bodo Glimt.
Yeah, the magnificent Bodo Glimt, who were confirmed as champions last weekend. In 26 games this season, they've won 23, drawn 2 and lost just 1. The latest win came now against a sort of perennial heavyweights, Rosenborg. Now, I think the context here is important. Like, they've had a bit of a celebration this week, and Rosenborg, I think their wage budget is something like three or four times higher than Bodo Glimt. So they're, you know, the team you expect to at least give them a game. Bodo Glimt won 5-1, as you'd expect. So that means they've now scored 90 goals in 26 games. They are the all-time sort of top scorers in the Norwegian league. They've got four more games to go in which to take it over 100 goals scored for what is a truly, truly bonkers season. And I think fair play to their Twitter admin guy for allowing himself a moment of banter, having sort of having trounced Rosenborg. So they tweeted, thanks for the guard of honour, but you didn't have to stay standing for the full 90 minutes.
Now, you've spent a lot of time in Malta with John Arne Riise, Lars, haven't you? Have you seen this wonderful clip of a power cut happening in the stadium?
It doesn't surprise me that that happened.
It's amazing. It's a penalty in a game. I don't know who the teams are, forgive me. STA versus MRS. So who's that? Stalybridge Celtic versus Mars. Mars are 2-0 up away at Stalybridge Celtic. And someone is taking a penalty, and literally as he strikes the ball, the power in the stadium all goes. It is absolutely fantastic. So go and see that on the Twitter. Hey, can we finish this podcast, Barry, very briefly, because we've been going on too long, with the three mishaps of Barry Glendening? I think our listeners would like to hear what's happened to you in the last 3 days.
Well, I'm not sure it's going to be of any interest to anyone, but you found it all very amusing. But my last 3 days have got off to spectacularly bad starts. On Saturday, I fell down the stairs after, you know, planting my bare foot on the top step. It slid out from under me, and I did that, you know, the EastEnders suspense music, injuring my ankle in the process. Then yesterday, I woke up to find my boiler was on the blink, so I had no hot water and continue to have no hot water and no heat. And this morning, when I was thinking things couldn't get much worse, I knocked over a freshly brewed pot of coffee, which is currently in a puddle all over my kitchen floor. So I have to go and clean that up as soon as we're done. So yeah, hopefully that's the end of it. They say these things come in threes.
Well, I enjoyed that tremendously. And what a wonderful way to end. Barry, I wish you better luck in the next 3 days. Thank you for your time, Barry.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Faye.
Always a pleasure, Max.
We'll be back on Wednesday this week.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.